The R.R. Campbell Writes Cast is brought to you in part by listeners like you. Learn more about the great rewards available to Writes Cast contributors by visiting patreon.com/writescast. Thanks for listening. Hey, hi, hello, and welcome to episode 9 of the R.R. Campbell Writes Cast. I'm R.R. Campbell, and for this episode of the show, I spoke with author Kristen A. Oakley about the hybrid publishing process. Kristen's debut novel, Carpe Diem Illinois, won the 2014 Chicago Writers Association Book of the Year Award for non-traditionally published fiction. The Independent Author Network listed it as a finalist for 2015 Book of the Year, and it was also a runner-up in the 2016 Shelf Unbound Best Indie Book Competition. Kristen is the past president and co-founder of InPrint Professional Writers Organization, a board member of the Chicago Writers Association, the managing editor of the Write City magazine, and a UW-Madison Division of Continuing Studies writing instructor. With accolades like that, it's no wonder I found our conversation on hybrid publishing to be both substantive and illuminating. So, without further ado, let's get right into this WritesCast interview with Kristen A. Oakley, author of Carpe Diem Illinois and God on Mayhem Street. Thank you, Kristen, for joining me on the show.
Thank you, Ryan, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, this is great. My pleasure. So we'll start then. We're talking about the hybrid publishing process. How would you personally define that hybrid publishing approach? What sort of elements does it incorporate from indie publishing, and what do you see coming into it from the more traditional publishing side?
Well, hybrid publishing is basically indie publishing, but it is hiring somebody to do all the work for you. So Sure. You hire a publisher to do the formatting, to put the artwork together for your cover page or any artwork inside. They also do distribution. They might have an editor that they can hire for you. So all of those are done for you, which was nice for me. I didn't want to have to deal with that. I just wanted to concentrate on the writing. It's also a publisher you're dealing with rather than something like CreateSpace. So you have that expertise behind you, which is similar to the traditional publishing. The main difference between it and indie publishing is indie publishing, you can print on demand, which is very nice and cost effective. In my case, my publisher required me to order several boxes of books. So I had to put a lot of money up front, which is the one downside of it. The thing that's similar to traditional publishing with this hybrid publishing is the publisher vets you. So in other words, they won't just publish any work. They have their name on it as well, and they want to make sure it's quality work. So that is also nice. When I go to Barnes & Noble, I say I have a publisher, and they will accept my books. Small publishing houses and small bookstores are the same way. Whereas if you go through CreateSpace or Lulu or one of those other places, you might have more difficulty getting those shelf space in the big stores.
And what was the name of the actual publisher that you worked with specifically for listeners who might be interested?
Her name is Kristen Mitchell, and she's Little Creek Press. You can look her up, littlecreekpress.com. She's in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. So she's local for me. I'm in Madison.
And so what led you to discover this approach? What was sort of your journey into whether it was meeting Kristen, or did you just find Little Creek online, or what was that journey like for you?
Well, with my first book, Carpe Diem Illinois, I had finished it in 2014, I think, yes. And I went to the Writers Institute at UW-Madison and I actually pitched it to agents, and I had some interest pages and full manuscripts, but nothing came of that. And I also sent out query letters to about 30, 40 agents. Nothing came of that. And I knew the book was really good and it was sitting there, and I'm getting older. And the book was sitting there. So I thought finally self-publishing had come to be acceptable. When I first started writing, it wasn't, but in the last few years, it was. So I thought, well, I'm going to look into this. At the same time, I was moderating a panel discussion at the Writers Institute of little local press, small presses. And Kristen Mitchell's publication, she was actually on the panel. And I talked to her about it afterwards. I liked her in particular because she is a graphic artist by design, and her covers are gorgeous. And I thought, well, I've worked on this book for 6 years. I want it to look really good.
I'm going to spend some money.
Yeah, right. And so I talked to her about it. And then that fall, her publishing company put together the Southwest Wisconsin Book Festival in Mineral Point. So I went to that to pick her brain some more about how this whole process worked, and decided at that point, yes, I wanted to go with her with this series.
Well, and I think that too, you know, as part of that story, I think it's really a testament to a couple of things, one of which is the value in being at a conference like that. That's, of course, where you and I had the opportunity to meet, was at the UW Writers Institute this year. If there's any listeners out there who are interested in getting involved or they'd like to learn more, especially if you're based in the Midwest, I strongly recommend that conference, which is normally, it's normally in April every year. It was a little earlier this year, but those are always great opportunities to meet people and stumble into, you know, these sorts of things that you might not have otherwise known existed.
Exactly.
So it sounds like then you realized that this approach was right for you because you had been trying to go that, you know, the hard traditional route, and then you had the opportunity to meet Kristen and things just kind of took off from there. Would you say that it is sort of the offer of the ability to take care of things like cover art, the accessibility into things like Barnes & Noble and other bookstores that really gave this approach a leg up for you?
Yes, definitely. I like to be in charge of, I have some art background myself, so I like to be in charge of the cover. And the title was very important to me. Another key thing to this, of course, is timing. If an agent had taken the book, it might have been a year, 2 years, or who knows how long before they found a publisher interested in the book. And then once the publisher is interested, on the average, it's 18 months before the book is actually in your hands. And I didn't want to wait that long. I wanted the book out. So I determine how quickly the book comes out. Now, I say that with a grain of salt because I always think it's going to come out. I always expect it to come out sooner than it does, but I do a lot of editing and re-editing, and I have a really good editor I work with. It ends up taking longer than I think, but that's okay. You know, it's got to be the perfect book that I, as perfect as I can get it at that time. But again, I'm in control of all that, which is awesome. I also get all the proceeds. I do pay Little Creek Press for distribution costs, but other than that, I get everything.
That's fantastic. I mean, it sounds like there's a really good balance of control that stays with you versus the opportunity to sort of pass along some of those other things that are not necessarily a certain writer's forte.
Right, exactly.
Now, looking at that, you know, sort of process overall, we've had an opportunity to kind of explore what some of those advantages are to pursuing that. Were there any potential downsides that you saw, or some things that other writers might not be, that might not work as well for them as they did perhaps for you?
Well, the biggest one is expense. If you do go self-publishing on CreateSpace, it doesn't have to cost you anything. However, I always say spend $1,000 to $2,000, even if you go on CreateSpace. Spend a good $1,000 to $2,000 just on the editing process, and a couple hundred more for a really decent cover. Hire somebody to get a good cover for you. That will make a world of difference. But really, you don't have to spend any money at all on CreateSpace. For me, it was expensive to go through the publisher to pay for their costs. And then again, to buy all these boxes. And the first time I did it, the minimum amount of books I had to buy was 750. Hmm. And I went ahead and got 1,500 because I thought, well, they're in my house. Yep. I have to get them out there and sell them. Mm-hmm. The second time they dropped the number and I only got 500 books. But that's the downside. You need to have some cash. You need to have some cash on hand. And you know it's going to take a while to recoup those costs. The other thing is, a lot of people think, well, you go traditional, you're going to have marketing background. People are going to help you with that. That's not always the case, but if you're lucky, you get some kind of an advance, maybe $5,000 as a first-time author, traditionally published, and that can go for marketing, a new website, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Some traditionally published authors I know actually have a publicist as well that yep. helps set up appointments like this, podcast mm-hmm. that you can get to. I don't have that, so I have to do that all on my own. But I think that's more and more typical of even traditionally published authors. They still have to do a lot of their own marketing. So that, you know, that's a disadvantage, but that's something that we all just kind of have to face now. All authors do.
Yeah, and no matter the route that you ultimately pursue, they're all going to have their advantages or disadvantages, which is one of the reasons why I thought this would be a really good topic to cover in a podcast, because it is one that I don't think you run into as frequently when speaking with authors at places like conferences or online or what have you. And it's really nice to know, I think, that there is this sort of third way, so to speak.
Right, and the other advantage is with a publisher, you can hire them for whatever you want. I hired them for everything. Mm-hmm. But if you just really like their cover, their artwork, hire them for that. Or if you don't want to have to deal with distributing the books yourself, If you don't want to figure out how to format on Kindle or whatever it is, you can hire them for those different things. So it doesn't have to be cost prohibitive depending upon what your needs are.
Yeah, it's a much more, it seems like a sort of a la carte service. It's like you're taking the best of both worlds in a way, if you really want to put it that way.
Right.
And then thinking too about, I know you were talking about the timelines for publication. We kind of walked through, for example, what the traditional route might look like. And again, that's super indefinite because it depends in the first place on your ability to get an agent and then the agent's ability to find a publisher that's willing to take that on. I know you mentioned your timeline was a little flexible, but what did it actually look like going this hybrid route from whatever you would consider to be the start of that process to the time you actually held the book in your hands?
Well, okay, if I can remember better, the second book, God and Mayhem Street, just came out last September. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping to get it out for the Writers Institute in 2015. I sent it to my editor, and she said, no, it needs a lot more work. So mm-hmm. It took another year, and I was hoping to get it out by 2016, and still worked on more editing. By the time I got all the editing to exactly where I wanted, to the time it was actually published, I think it was about 3 months. The first thing, of course, was to make sure I had the manuscript perfect. Mm-hmm. And my editor does both developmental and copy editing.
Oh, that's good.
So we do that together. And then I also do something called, myreader.com. I don't know if you know that, but you can actually, it reads the book out loud to you.
Oh, that's cool.
It is. It's amazing what you catch with that. So I did that, got that where I wanted it, and I've got some author friends that wrote reviews, so I can make sure I can get those on the back cover of the book. Mm-hmm. And we, of course, got the cover lined up exactly the way we wanted it. I actually took the picture for the second book, which was kind of fun to have that on the cover. And so then for her to get it all together and then the formatting and everything else, it took just a couple of months.
Well, it's really not all that bad, all things considered. I think the key part of all of that, like you said, was you were working with an editor and you knew that you wanted to make it right and make it the best book that you could make it. And so I think that's something that I think any listener should keep in mind is no matter what publication route that you're going to go, find yourself a good editor, find yourself some good beta readers, network. Like you said, you had an opportunity to reach out to some of your author friends to get reviews for the back of the book, etc. It's all about taking advantage of all the people around us, using one another's strengths to help each other out and making sure that by the time we do publish, no matter what route it is, we've got the best thing that we know we can create at that time out there.
Exactly. And I think we get very impatient because we've been working with these books for years. We're ready to get it out, and we finally have it done, and we think we just the next day it'll be in our hands, and then we realize, no, it still needs more work, and we have to kind of take a breath and step back and make sure it is as good as it possibly can get at that point. That's the way I feel about all my books. Each book is as good as I possibly can get it at that time in my career, and it does. It takes time, and it does take a team of people, as you say. All these people help.
Yeah, writing itself can be a very lonely path, but the publication process, the editing process doesn't have to be, and I really don't think it should be, really. I mean, you got to rely on, like we've said, the strengths of others and help them when you can make their book the best that it can be as well.
Right.
So why don't you tell us a little bit then, specifically about Carpe Diem Illinois and God on Mayhem Street.
The first book, Carpe Diem Illinois, is about Leo. He's a Chicago reporter that's down on his luck. He's had some tough times, and he is offered a chance to redeem himself by looking into a small town that doesn't have any schools. They basically unschool. And he thinks, well, who cares about that? I write front page news. I don't want to have to take this on. It's ridiculous. And then he finds out that the founder of the town's son has driven his motorcycle into the car of a woman, and she happens to be the wife of the Illinois state senator, who is trying to outlaw homeschooling in Illinois. So now he's thinking, there's something going on in this little town. I'm going to go investigate. So that's what he does in the first book. The second book, Leo finds himself, he's a Chicago guy, so he's in Chicago a lot. He finds himself at Spiaggia's downtown on Michigan Avenue. He's going to interview the front-running presidential candidate who is openly gay. So it's the interview of a lifetime for him. He gets a phone call during the interview from his brother saying that his father has suffered a near fatal heart attack and he has to leave immediately and go to the family farm in Endeavor, Wisconsin. So he has to cut this interview short and go stay with his dad, and he's estranged from his dad, so it's a tough situation. The presidential candidate decides to come to the little town.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, the village president of the town is quite a character and the villain in the story. And so, all havoc breaks loose in this little town. Right. And it's a funny story about the town, Endeavor. I thought I had created that name in the first book. There's one mention of Endeavor, Wisconsin. What a cool name for a little town. In the second book, as I was writing it, my editor said to me, by the way, there really is an Endeavor, Wisconsin. And I said, you're kidding me. So she said, we better go investigate. So we went up there. It's near Portage, the Dells area. And there's 450 people in this little town. In my town, there's 1,500. It's a little more prosperous than the actual Endeavor.
It's an alternate timeline. You can brush it under the rug like that kind of thing, right? Yeah, exactly.
But what happened then, so we met the librarian and I told her I was working on this book, and then they invited me to do a book signing. So I went last fall, I guess it was like November, and they had 10 or 12 people came, and they all brought, small towns, lots of food, and we had beer. They were wonderful. And they bought 22 books.
Wow.
So it was wonderful, little connection to this town. The book also takes place a lot in Madison and also Chicago, which is fun. So yeah, I'm working on the third book in the series, but I've taken a diversion. Leo's actually really mad at me right now
because
back shelf. I'm working on a young adult dystopian novel, I actually pitched to agents at the Institute this year. So two agents are looking for pages.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I'm trying to get that to my editor. Just one, have her look it over real quick before I send
it out. Before you send it all out. Yeah, absolutely. Because then you're just going to be playing the waiting game on it anyway.
Right, exactly.
Yep, and that's a tough game to play. It doesn't matter what stage you're at, but especially when you're waiting to hear back from agents, that gets to be a real thumb twiddler, as they might say.
Right. Well, in the meantime, so I had I talked to a particle physicist for this young adult book, and he said, I've always wanted to write a novel. I said, well, that would be fun. Let's do it. So in the meantime, while I'm waiting for the agents, I'm going to start a science fiction novel with this man, which will be interesting too. So lots going on.
There's a lot going on. I've never taken on a collaborative writing project like that, but I feel like that's got to pose, I'm sure it will pose, its own unique challenges, but also, again, you're using the strengths of somebody else and he uses your strengths there and you can put something really cool together, I'm sure.
Right. And I've never done it before either. So it's quite an experiment. But all of this process, everything, it's a learning experience, which is just wonderful. I would like to try Create Space one day, maybe with a novella or something like that. I like to try to learn all of the industry aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I've already gotten something published, I know that I could probably conquer these things. But yes, collaboration, it'll be fun.
Absolutely. Well, then why don't we hop in here? I know you have a selection prepared to read from Carpe Diem, Illinois. So if you feel like you'd like to do any sort of setup for this scene, I know it's the first chapter, so feel free to give us any additional info you think we might need and take it away as soon as you're ready to give us that reading.
Okay. No introduction needed. I'm just going to jump right in.
Carpe
Diem, Illinois, chapter 1. At the corner of Tiger Whip Road and Highway 20, Patrick Holden slumped over the handlebars of his idling Harley. The motorcycle's black leather seat and saddlebags were creased with age, the 20-year-old fenders dusty but barely scarred. Patrick hadn't aged as well as his bike. Years of fighting school administrators, education czars, and a weird mix of politicians had creased more than his outward appearance. It had creased his soul. The motorcycle's headlight illuminated the decaying facade of an abandoned shed. Swirling farm dust mixed with dry hay made Patrick cough, leaving a gritty taste in his mouth. He ran his gloved fingers over the neat stitches holding the cycle's seat together and regretted the late-night meeting. He had been persuasive, articulate, and even-tempered, but the meeting had been a disaster. Illinois State Senator Christopher Shaw, in all his patronizing benevolence, had refused to see the obvious dangers of his legislation. Instead, threatened by reason, the senator stormed out of his office. When the door slammed, Patrick realized he was no longer sitting. His skinny, 6-foot frame leaned over the senator's wooden desk. His hand splayed on the maple, leaving damp prints. What had he done? Perhaps his father was right. Perhaps he had gone about this the wrong way, screwed things up, and jeopardized the future of Carpe Diem. The idling purr of the motorcycle's engine soothed some of Patrick's despair, until a semi-trailer roared past. He shielded his eyes from a tornado of dirt and gravel and watched the truck cut a path of light on the dark highway. Cutting a path through the darkness, what an idea. turning the motorcycle back onto the two-lane highway he fishtailed, then accelerated to 80 miles an hour. Alexandra Shaw steered her silver BMW down Highway 20 toward home. She had spent an inspiring day in Chicago at a novel writing workshop, followed by dinner with other passionate writers. She'd been told several times that her story would make an excellent book. Thrilled, she hummed along to the sultry voice of Nora Jones on the radio. She couldn't remember ever being this happy. She slowed through a Midwestern town, passing three churches and a corresponding number of neighborhood taverns, then sped by endless farmland crawling with late-night tractors lighting up rows of dried corn stalks. At a sharp bend in the highway, she spotted the sign, Carpe Diem, 5 miles. That sign always intrigued her. Now she took it as a good omen and even considered stopping for a cup of coffee until she heard the muffled, "Won't you take me to Funky Town?" ringtone of her cell phone. It was probably Natalia, eager to hear about her workshop. Alexander grabbed her purse from the passenger seat and felt inside, but couldn't locate the phone. Her eyes on the road, she dumped the bag's contents. She rifled through gold pens, a mini notepad, and her leather wallet. "Won't you take me to Funky Town?" She had it. She looked at her right hand, a packet of tissues. She snatched another glance at the road. "Won't you take me to Funky Town?" A single light came over the nearest hill. A car with a busted headlight? A motorcycle? Yes. Now where was the damned phone? She reached between the leather seats. Nothing. She felt on the floor and found a hardened French fry. The phone stopped asking to take it to Funky Town. Why hadn't she listened to her husband and gotten the car's Bluetooth option? The BMW's interior brightened. Alexander jerked her head up. The motorcycle was driving in her lane, straight at her. She punched the horn, but the motorcycle didn't swerve. She yanked the steering wheel to the right, her foot smashing the brake pedal, the car's tires screaming. It wasn't enough. The motorcycle slammed into her. The wrenching scream of tortured metal filled her ears. She buried her head in her arms. Shattered glass spit at her, pinpricking her bare hands. She tasted blood. The steering wheel's airbag crushed her against the driver's seat. Driver's door smashed inward, the side airbag deploying too late. The car began to roll, compressed, gasping for breath, strapped into the tumbling car. Alexandra flipped over and over as if on a crazed amusement park ride. "My book will never be published. Natalia, I'm sorry." Right before passing out, she saw something bounce off the airbag, the delinquent cell phone.
Wow, there you have it. There's an inciting incident, all in one chapter, packing that punch right from the get-go.
Right.
Well, what I think was really cool in there is, you know, even some of the things that you've mentioned over the course of the podcast so far. You know, we have this character, Alexandra, who's coming back from a novel writing workshop. You know, she's in the Chicago area. So there's some really cool elements of incorporating what you know. It's that classic writing what you know that seeps in even on these earliest pages.
Right. And it actually takes place, the corner of Tiger Whip Road and Highway 20 is an actual location. I used to live in Freeport, Illinois, which is west of Rockford. And the Highway 20 that goes all the way to Galena, right before you get to Stockton, that's where that corner is. And so whenever we drive by that, we say, "Oh, there's Patrick's corner. There he is on his motorcycle." So yes, that also helps with all the descriptions, you know, all the physical and the smells and the sights and everything. It really helps if you know the area.
Yeah, I think even beyond that, then, another question I had from that kind of popped up earlier when we were talking about, you know, the arc of each book, or at least the setup for both of the books in the series so far, was what kind of research, aside from being familiar with these areas, you know, for maybe the political underpinnings of all of this, what some of the research looked like that went into writing these books?
Well, the first book was easy as far as research was concerned, because I unschooled both my daughters.
Okay.
Now 25 and almost 22. Mm-hmm. I admit it. Mm-hmm. But I was a homeschool advocate for quite a long time. I served a couple support groups and worked at the conferences. And I wrote a couple articles for Home Education magazine. So I knew a lot about that. I did have a couple of Illinois homeschool gurus look over the legal aspects of it to make sure I had everything right. And then I had, as you said, I have an amazing critique group that I needed in particular because, of course, my slant is pro-unschooling, mm-hmm. but I didn't want this to be preachy and all about that. So that's why I have Leo in there. He's looking at it from fresh eyes. He's never heard of this before. He knows about homeschooling, but not in this way. And so that helped. And then also just elevated it. And it's got the story about the little town and the unschooling, but it's really his story and his struggle and how he overcomes a lot of his demons. In the second book, I can't tell you because I'll give away some things. Why, in particular, the villain of the town wants the Townsend farm. I did have to research quite a bit, and I asked a couple of people. I went up to Marquette County, which is the county that Endeavor is in, and talked to the sheriff there about police procedure, because one of the last scenes, and not giving anything away, of the book.
No spoilers.
He said, no spoilers. He said, the way I had it written, he said, yeah, that's something you'd see in a movie, but that's not real life. That's not how it really happens. So he was very helpful. And I find that, I don't know how much research if you've done, Ryan, in the past for your books, but you find that people are very eager to give you any kind of information. They're thrilled to talk about what it is they're working on or what their profession is, like this particle physicist that I mentioned. They just love sharing their knowledge, their information with any of this. And that's fun, too. That's fun to sit and pick their brains about these ideas and make sure, even though it's fiction, you want it grounded in actual reality. You really want it to make sense, and people are willing to do that, which is really wonderful.
No, that is really cool. And that plays in really nicely to something that I'm kind of confronting right now with the current book that I'm writing, where I have a character who becomes the subject of an IRS audit, and I've been doing plenty of research on my own and hoping that the government isn't seeing that and thinking I'm up to nefarious, you know, things of that nature, whatever that might be. But at the same time, I myself am struggling a little bit with, one, I would like to actually find someone that I can interview, because I do agree that's got to be a fantastic way to make sure that you are staying true to life. But at the same time, the way I'm looking at structuring my plot, I'm asking myself, well, how hard do I want to commit to keeping it, you know, tied to real life versus what's going to serve the drama of the story best? Was there any sort of question like that in your mind when you were trying to compare how procedural should I be versus how dramatic, quote unquote, should I be?
Yeah, I think we always struggle with that to some extent. One of the things that came up in the first book, they mentioned that in Iowa in the 1980s, there was an underground railroad for homeschoolers. If they found out in Iowa that you were homeschooling your children, they would take your children away from you.
Wow.
So parents knew that, and they would actually hide their kids or send them to the neighbors when they knew that the truant officer was coming over. And there's a little snippet, a sentence or two in the book about that. And I remember one of my friends read the book and she said, yeah, I really liked it, but I don't know, that just didn't seem real. And I had to say that actually was. So when you have extreme things like that, it might, you know, when I make a second printing of this book, maybe I'll put in some of the history of homeschooling in the book so people can see that's true. But yes, then you want, in the second book, there's this plot line that it seems very fantastical. And I don't care. You know, I'm going to include it. It is based in reality, and it's fun. It's a fun thing to think about, the potential of it. And I think it's okay. People will see that for what it is, you know, that it's part of the plot, and it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
And I think even, you know, Stephen King says something along those lines. I think it's probably in On Writing. He's talking about how at one point he caught a bunch of slack for the book's title's escaping me, but in that particular book, he was talking about how there was some sort of secret code or secret agreement or language among people that work in a carnival setting, for example. And a lot of folks that had worked in that industry for a long time were like, well, that doesn't exist. That's not a real thing. And he went out of his way to say, well, that's where the fiction comes in. You know, you get those liberties if you really want to take them.
Right. Right.
Well, any last parting words of wisdom, any last thoughts on the hybrid publishing process or research for that matter that you'd like to share with listeners before we say goodbye for now?
Yeah, I think maybe the main thing with people, if they're interested in hiring a publisher to do any aspect of their work, is to, of course, you can Google it. You can look at hybrid publishing online. I noticed that there's a really good article, Writer's Digest article by Brian A. Klems, K-L-E-M-S. What is hybrid publishing? Here are four things all writers should know. I think that's a great article, where to begin. If you do find 5 to 10 publishers that you think you might want to work with, before you do anything, talk to authors that have used those publishers. Call them up, pick their brains. What did they like? What didn't they like? something that worked for them may not work for you and vice versa, but you need to really find out, because I do know a few authors that have gone this route and have not had good experiences for whatever reason. It just hasn't worked out for them. So if you go this route, you've got to do a little research. You got to really make sure you talk to as many people as you can about it. I'd be happy to talk to people if they want to check out my website, kristinoakley.net, and just ask me some questions on it, or if they want to know more about Little Creek Press, I'd be happy to tell them about that as well. But do your research. That's the main thing.
Just like anything in life, do your research, whether it's buying a car or writing a book and trying to get it published. Just, you know, you want to make sure you do it right.
Exactly.
Well then, thank you, Kristen, for joining me. I really appreciate having you on.
Thank you so much. It was fun.
That's all for my interview with Kristen A. Oakley, author of Carpe Diem Illinois and God on Mayhem Street. Thanks again to Kristen for being on the show. For more from Kristen, be sure to head over to her website at kristinoakley.net and follow her on Twitter at kristinoakley. If you like what you've heard here, there are plenty more episodes of the R.R. Campbell WritesCast available. For more author interviews, writing tips, and updates on future episodes of the show, you can always visit rrcampbellwrites.com or use iTunes keyword WritesCast to get future episodes delivered directly to your desktop or mobile device. I'd also like to remind listeners that I now offer manuscript assessment services. Whether you've got a handful of pages or a full manuscript ready and waiting, let's work together to make your story the best that it can be. You can find more information on services offered at rrcampbellwrites.com/editing-services. Upcoming episodes of the WritesCast include a bonus episode to be released on June 30th featuring Daniel Swenson, author of The Shadow Above the Flames. On July 7th, we'll hear from Danielle Maurer on the importance of perseverance, and July 21st will mark the debut of an episode featuring award-winning young adult author Valerie Beale on how to promote your work via traditional media. This episode of the WritesCast may be drawing to a close, but you can always get in on the conversation on Twitter by following me at @IamRRCampbell or by shooting me an email through my website's contact page at rrcampbellwrites.com. I'd love to hear from you. As always, until next time, write on and write well.